Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, where we talk bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den here in the heart of the northwest of England. This is the second part of episode 71, which was all about the ZX Spectrum. This really isn't a second part, it's more of an interactive booklet to read alongside the first part and to put in the cassette at key moments and type load complete bobbins. Crack open the hobnobs, pour yourself a brew as me and resident rules lawyer Josh Blythe look back at our experiences with personal computers. The rise of computer games and personal computers in the home are intricately linked with RPGs and were an important common ground between us becoming friends, as RPGs would prove to be. Also in this episode, we look at Rippers, the Savage World setting that we've been playing in over the past 6 months. And also the crisis of confidence when creating a setting from scratch. I'll be back at the end to say goodbye. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Starburst memories!
Welcome to the Zoom of role-playing rambling. This is Starburst Memories. We don't have this segment very often, but this is where we look at the hinterland, at the side of role-playing, things that are role-playing adjacent. And this time we're going to look at technology and computer gaming. I've got Blythe with me. Hello there, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
And you're coming live from Little Wigan.
Live from Little Wigan, yes.
And I'm in Adlington, and we're beaming together with the miracles of modern technology.
Yeah, who knew that this kind of thing would be possible when we go back 40 years?
You're not really in Tilsley, is it? It's at Astley, isn't it, where you are?
Well, it depends. If you ask my wife, we're in Astley, but we are really in Tilsley. Estate agents call it Astley. It's Tilsley.
Yeah.
It's a long-going marital dispute. She's a bit snobby, and Astley's quite posh. And Tilsley's a bit more working class. So me, being my working class hero type act, I go for the Tilsley. But once on a long walk, we did find a little boundary stone that proved we were in Tilsley, but she refuses to accept it. Well, there you go.
There we go, yeah. I'm in Adlington, where the metropolitan liberal elite come to die. We're going to talk about computers and computer games. So this year is 50 years since Dungeons and Dragons was launched. And if you think about it, with the gaming consoles and personal computing, it kind of got a concurrent history. It's around the same time. I think the first computer games console was in 1972. I think Atari's came second. I think that was like the Pong game. Remember the Pong game?
Pong, I do remember.
Yeah, Pong, yeah. Go around to my cousins and I thought it was amazing, spending hours playing the Pong game.
Yeah, they were very, that was a very middle class thing, wasn't it? Having one of those consoles. I don't remember. I didn't know anyone who had one of those.
My cousins who lived in a bungalow on Ladybridge, quite posh.
Yeah.
They had one. And yeah, they made
a big point. They were quite expensive, weren't they? And it was kind of interesting because it wasn't like other technology like video recorders where people who were wealthy got them first and then everyone got one. Those Atari things, the wealthier people had them. But then
yes,
other things came along that were actually a bit better. They were actually a bit cheaper as well.
Yeah, yeah. And it was democratized very much by Spectrum. Sinclair, that he wanted everybody to have them in their homes. But I think it is fair to say that the development of computer gaming and our experience with role-playing games, it did run alongside each other. It was happening at the same time.
Yeah.
If you pick up a magazine like White Dwarf and Imagine, they'd have articles about microcomputers or gaming on computers.
Yeah, and there were attempts to kind of tie the two together. So you would always get those programs for creating characters, wouldn't you? That was always a popular one, wasn't it? So a character generator program in BASIC that you would type in to your home computer, and it was supposed to create a, I don't know, first level characters for D&D, or rune quest characters, or traveler characters, or something like that. And it never works. You know, either you'd make, there was either typo in the program in the magazine, you'd make a typo and it wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Or it did something quite unimpressive by today's standards. So, it,
yeah,
you know, for example, it might create traveler characters, but all it did was create, it rolled 2d6 six times. That's it. You know,
yeah,
that was all it really did.
Because it
wasn't complicated enough to do the whole character creation thing. That would take forever.
And you had to transcribe it off the screen because, if I remember rightly, the Sinclair printer consisted of a silver toilet roll type contraption.
Yeah, was it like a thermal thing or something?
Yeah.
Was it? I don't know. I just imagined that it was like a thermal
thing. I think Moggy had one, didn't he? Because I think his family, his dad was a teacher, I think, and he impressed upon them the need to have good computer knowledge. And he used to come in with printouts on this silver paper.
He did, yeah, yeah, yeah. Having a printer, that was quite something. It was all right having a Spectrum or a ZX81 or whatever they were called. But having a printer was like, wow.
Yeah.
Mind you, I still think that's the thing, having a printer. Find me a blinking printer that works at home. Oh, man. Yeah. Paying, aren't they?
It's a wireless
printer. Wireless printers, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got massive leaps in technology, but so many printers have lagged behind, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah.
And it is remarkable when you step back and think about it that we are of a generation that participated and contributed to the development of personal computing. We lived through an age where it emerged. We saw the very beginnings of it and saw it emerge. Mm-hmm. So we're not like the previous generation who saw it emerge but didn't know what to do with it. We were active users of it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, I remember starting work, my very first job, and I was marched into the office. I was like wet behind the ears, office junior at the local authority. And there's a computer in a corner with a dust sheet over it. And all the blokes in the office, they were in the, I mean, they're probably somewhere in the 30s, 40s, 50s. Oh, looked at me and went, well, we don't know what that is. We don't know what to do with that, but maybe you do as a young person. And I looked at it and thought, no. I went, oh, right, okay. I thought, no, I don't really know what to do with it. I don't have no idea what to do with it. Because that was it. I can remember that being a thing of, I can remember being at college and being, there was the odd computer course and stuff. Or even at school, they would talk about computers, wouldn't they? But you'd sit there bewildered thinking, what are you talking about? What are you supposed to do with this thing?
Yeah.
You know, it was a weird time because you had the idea that computers and NASA. NASA had computers. And the CIA might have had computers. They did incredible things because they filled a room and they launched spaceships, yeah? So you thought computers must do stuff because NASA has them. But the one in the school computer club did bugger all, really.
Yeah.
You just play games on it. And I remember, I think we did have a few lessons at school right at the end about computing. And it wasn't like coding, was it? They didn't teach programming. It was more just like about information technology. And I remember thinking, well, I don't know what they're talking about. And I don't think they knew what they were talking about.
No, absolutely not. I mean, we might go into this a little bit because what we normally do in this segment is bring some artifact together and talk about what it resonates. And I think that is so true, that idea that it was a solution in search of a problem, in the same way that AI is these days. It's something that everybody talks about, but gradually people start to understand how to incorporate it in their lives and make use of it. And I think it is good to think that we were the generation that were around when that was happening. It's quite alarming now because my son's doing history and it's GCSE time at the moment. You know, it's quite intense. But he refers to the 20th century as the 1900s. And I keep saying to him, don't call it the 1900s. It just sounds a long time ago.
So he reminds me further ago than it is, you know.
He reminds me that it is a long time ago, comparatively speaking. But before we get into our artifacts, I have done a prefab sprout game.
Okay.
I hope you'll indulge me.
I will.
So this is where we come up with four items. Actually, I think I've got five here. Yeah, I've got five different titles. And these are five different titles of Spectrum games.
Okay.
Spectrum games that came out in the 80s. However, one of them is not a Spectrum game. One of them is a role-playing game that you'll find on DriveThruRPG.
Okay. All right. So still a game, but not a computer game.
Exactly, yeah.
All right. Okay. Fire away.
Here goes. So your first one is, my name is Uncle Groucho. You win a fat cigar. So this is a text-based adventure where you play Groucho Marx.
My name is Uncle Groucho. You win a fat cigar.
Yeah. I think the Marx Brothers at the time, we would be watching those because he'd be on BBC Two, didn't they?
Yeah, there's a bit of plausibility about that because, yeah, I mean, the things we were watching on the TV, you were watching Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy and Harold Lloyd and all that kind of thing. They were on the TV, weren't they?
Yeah, staples. So, staples of children's.
Yeah, So just to clarify, is the role-playing game that you would find on Drive-Thru from the 80s too? Or is that from now?
No, it's from now. It's from now.
Ah, well, that's interesting because, Uncle Groucho. All right, yeah.
My name is Uncle Groucho. You win a fat cigar.
I mean, okay. It sounds rubbish.
It does.
But there you go.
Don't hold on to your hearts. It gets worse. Okay. Fat Worm blows up Sparky. Fat Worm blows up Sparky.
So from fat cigar to Fat Worm. Is fat a feature in this?
It is. It was the 80s, wasn't it?
Okay.
Yeah.
What is it again? Fat Worm
blows up Sparky.
And what's the nature of this game?
Okay, it's a worm. It's a worm being chased around the circuit board of the Spectrum itself. Okay.
Well, that does sound very computer gamey. The description sounds computer gamey, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like a role playing game. Sounds like something that would kind of fit the bill for an 80s Spectrum game. Well, that's what you would do. So, okay, all right, go on.
Next one, conniving cat burglars. Conniving cat burglars were crafty cats in a wealthy neighborhood go in search of riches. Conniving cat burglars. Okay.
All right. The spider sense is tingling with that one. I think that's potentially the RPG so far. Of the three at the moment, that sounds like the dodgy RPG from Drive-Thru that someone would come up with.
Next one is Rockstar Ate My Hamster. You need to put together a successful rock band and take them to the top of the charts. Rockstar Ate My Hamster.
Well, that does sound quite 80s, doesn't it? I mean, there's an allusion there, isn't it, to Freddie Starr? Did Freddie Starr eat a hamster? Allegedly.
He did eat a hamster. Allegedly.
I don't think he really did, but that sounds very 80s. So far, the conniving cat burglars is the one I'm honing in on. I'm zoning in on us, the RPG. But go on.
Eric and the floaters. Lay bombs and blow people up whilst getting out of the way.
Well, that sounds like a computer game. I mean, if that's the role-playing game, it sounds dreadful. If that's the role, you know... Are these descriptions genuine, or have you made the descriptions?
No, the descriptions are genuine.
All genuine, even for the role-playing game.
Yeah.
Right, well, that sounds like a computer game.
There you go. So what are you going for, then?
I think I'd have to go for the conniving cat burglars. I think I could be wrong, of course, but the others all sounded like quite limited concepts, which I don't mean that in a bad way, but you know, like a computer game, which is, as a computer game would be, quite a limited concept, wouldn't it? Whereas conniving cat burglars, where you play cats, sounds like a slightly dodgy role-playing game off drive-through. But go on, am I wrong?
No, you're correct. Well done. You win this time. Conniving cat burglars is a role-playing game. Well done. Yeah.
Sounded like it. The others.
I'm pretty sure that I had some of these Spectrum games. I remember my name is Uncle Gretcho, you win a fat cigar.
I don't remember any of them.
Yeah.
I remember lots of them, but I don't remember them.
I think, do you remember Simon Frey at school? He used to be, for want of a better word, I mean, this is an old-fashioned word.
I do remember it, and I'm wondering what word you're going to use now to describe it, because I can think of a few.
But
do you want this podcast to get some content warning? Go on.
I suppose it was a bit of a spiv, wasn't it? It was a bit of a guy.
One way of putting it.
I don't know whether he did wear a pork pie hat or whether my memory and imagination has put a pork pie hat on him, but he definitely did come into school with a suitcase full of C90s and C60s full of Spectrum games, which he flogged up on the playground.
He did. And other merchandise.
Yeah, yes. Another contraband,
which we'll gloss over. Yeah, but yeah, he did. I remember that. He did, didn't he?
He was famous for that. He was famous for selling contraband, including Spectrum games. He was also famous for shouting down the school corridor the words for Forgotten Sons by Marillion.
For reasons best known to himself. I don't know why he did that, but there you go. He did.
And he eventually got suspended from school for mooning the staff room, I think.
He did. Yeah, he did, didn't he? Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I got all of these games from him on tape. And there were too many of them. And I got very dismissive of them very quickly.
Yeah.
My patience ran out with them very quickly because I didn't have the instructions for some of them as well. It wasn't like...
try and work out what to do.
Yeah. It wasn't intuitive like games are now. Even if you had something simple like a Lunar Lander, you had to work out where on the keyboard you did it. And he didn't always explain, did it, in the program what it was.
They were a very kind of mixed bag, I think, of games, because I can remember playing games and, as you said, being quite dismissive of some of them because some of them were rubbish. And then there were some that were great, which I'm sure we'll go on to talk about. Some that were great, really good. To be honest, I'd probably play now if I could. You know, I'd probably play them now. But you're right, there's a lot of them that were a bit dodgy, a bit rubbish, and you thought, it's a bit disappointing. Things moving on a screen. After a while, you very quickly get used to the idea of things are moving on a screen. You just want them to do interesting things, don't you? Rather than just move on a screen. And so that's all some of them did, really.
Yeah. When you could get them to load, that was always an issue as well. Particularly Simon Freeze. I think I got a refund on one of them. Anyway. I don't think he gave receipts. I think he took it on trust. He gave me my £1, principally £1 back of them.
Yeah. There's a lot of money in the 1900s.
D.D. Miles. Let's have a look at the artifacts then. Do you want me to start, or are you going to
start?
Go
on, you can start. Go on. What have you brought?
I've brought on a trolley. I'm rolling it in.
By the way, these are metaphorical, aren't they?
Hang on.
These are not literal.
No.
Well, mine aren't literal, because I haven't got them anymore. But
My first artifact is something that I have still got.
Oh, okay. All right.
Now, before the ZX Spectrum, I remember we used to play together handheld toys. They were, I think you had, did you have Invaders from Space or something?
Well, that's my item. My item is Invaders from Space, which was like a handheld, I wouldn't say pocket, it wouldn't be in your pocket, quite big. It was a handheld version of Space Invaders. So you had four little columns of Space Invaders that came down and you shot, essentially Space Invaders. I'm describing Space Invaders. No need to describe it, have I, surely. It was Space Invaders, but on a much smaller scale. So it was a much smaller screen, but you got the little Space Invaders coming down. So it was like the arcade game, but not as big. I'm not sure, but I'd not know that it had a spaceship going across the top. Like that. We may not have done. But that's all it did. And they came, you know, every time you cleared them, it just came down quicker and they got points. And that's what it was. There's awful lot of plastic. I remember there being an awful lot of plastic and not much screen. So it was a tiny screen with a very impressive plastic around it.
Yes. And I remember us playing that on your dining room table. It was very soon after we met each other, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably could have been before we got into role playing. It might have been.
Oh, yeah, I think it was. It was pretty soon. I think it was one of the first times that I met your parents, because I remember sitting at your dining table and playing, and we were swapping it between us, weren't we?
Yeah, they were. I suppose, yeah, they probably was before role playing, because they predated computers, didn't they?
You brought that artifact, Invaders from Space, and I brought this artifact, which I've still got. I've still got this. This is the Star Wars Electronic Battle Command. And it still works, this, but only half works. And when I say, I mean literally half works. Half the screen works. When I call it a screen, it's not a screen. It's a grid of 12 squares. The way this game worked is, well, it's too complicated to describe now. I won't describe how this, but it consists of LED red lights. That's all it is.
Yeah. And you're a grid of lights, isn't it? That flash. Again, looking at it, there's a lot of plastic and there's a lot of, like, there's different keys, like a keyboard thing, isn't there, on it?
Yeah.
It looks quite impressive, but it's not.
It was one of those items that was advertised by kids huddled around it and looking amazed by blowing up a TIE fighter. And you thought, I've got to get one of them.
I've got to get one of them. How could it? It couldn't possibly disappoint. It's Star Wars. It's a Star Wars computer game. It couldn't possibly disappoint, could it?
But looking at it now, I think it does disappoint. But I don't think back then it necessarily did. I think it did then.
I think it did. Oh, I remember thinking, it's hard to work out what the hell was going on with it. I think that was part of the problem. Again, because you got it out of the box and you probably got very excited about it, switched it on, lost the instructions, and spent years of your life pressing buttons and red lights came on. And I remember playing it and red lights would come on and flash, and then you'd hit something and you'd won, or you'd been hit and you'd lost, and you thought, well, I don't really know what I'm doing.
It's sort of like battleships, but TIE fighters, but the TIE fighters and the X-Wings are in your imagination. That's all. They don't exist in the game, do they? They're just red dots.
No, there's no graphics. It's just, it's like you say, it's kind of like battleships, isn't it? With flashing lights. Yeah.
It's nothing to look at, but I do remember playing it, and there are occasions where your enemy can be screened. You can be screened invisible. And it makes like a really impressive sound, well, not impressive, it makes sound effects of a siren and explosions, sort of an explosion. And there are occasions where when you're invisible or your enemy's invisible, where it just silently explodes and it just indicates on the screen with a flashing light that you've gone. And there was something quite thrilling about that. Well, maybe it was my imagination. Different times.
True, but that's not in Star Wars. That's Star Trek. Who designed this? Someone get confused.
I'm pretty sure
cloaking technology. That's like a Klingon thing, isn't it? In Star Trek, I don't recall anyone using that in Star Wars. They don't have cloaking, do they? They don't have invisibility.
I bet if you look hard enough, there's probably one that's been badged as Star Trek.
A different sticker on. Yeah. Kids don't know. Kids don't care. You're invisible.
So we both brought along those handheld games that we played. I used to have Astro Wars as well, which was like Galaxian, the one with the docking stage as well.
I remember quite liking that one.
Yeah,
it is quite good. That was quite good. Of the three we mentioned, I think that was probably the best one.
Yeah.
For me.
I'm going to bring in as my next artifact. You mentioned it, but the school computer, seeing that for the first time. And we kind of knew about computers, but to see a real live one with a green screen, it was a Commodore PET computer, I think. And it was called a PET computer, and they treated it like a PET. They locked it in a room, didn't they? And wheeled it out for us to kind of look at.
Yeah.
So it's some great novelty.
It was HAL.
Yes.
It's like ORAC or something. It did nothing.
All it did, it had a Pac-Man rip-off game, didn't it? Like a Munchie game, going around the mazes. And we just took turns going on that. And
yeah, there was a computer club, wasn't there? And everyone joined computer club. But really, they weren't interested in computers. You wanted to play the computer game. It was just an excuse to play the computer game. Yeah. That's all it was.
What was striking about it for me, though, is thinking about it when I've been thinking about this over the last few days, is it was the preserve of the maths department. So the maths department at school had it. Why did the maths department have it? They weren't doing any computation with it, were they? There was like this impression that we were going to use it to make great leaps in. We're still using log tables, weren't we? We're still using logarithm tables. So.
Yeah, log tables, trigonometry, and all that kind of thing. Yeah, you weren't using a computer. That was the thing. That was the thing with them. It was the strangest of times because people thought, "Oh, it was a computer," as if they could quite realise you had to program. Well, people did realise you had to program a computer, but people didn't quite grasp what that meant. So they were just got like. Oh, I'll turn this computer on. It'll be this computer, but to do incredible things. Only if you program it to do incredible things.
Yeah.
Oh, what's the point of that? Well, should I just go and do the incredible things myself then? You know, so not really realizing what they were capable of. It's kind of a stupid time, really.
It was. And when I think about it, the decade for me was bookended by two things. So at the beginning, there was that PET computer on a trolley. And then at the end of the decade, I was at college studying for my degree, and part of my degree was communication studies. My communication studies lecturer was showing us dial-up protocols where it was possible through this network, that they were going to send messages from Lancaster University to our college room. And this was going to be the basis upon which the future technology would be based. I was there for 40 minutes watching this green screen as it kept failing as the word hello came up on the screen and we sent hello back. It would literally have been quicker to get in a car from Ormskirk and drive up the M6 to Lancaster.
Pop your head around the door and say hello.
At that time, when I was at university, that's when I realised the potential, the creative potential of these computers, because we had a room that was full of Apple Macintosh computers. And at that time, I was using it to do layout for desktop publishing, using things like Studio 8, I think it was called, this graphics design software, manipulating photographs and things. And you thought, this is what computers can do. This is what they're for. They're full of creative potential. And I remember sending stuff to you saying, look what I've done on this.
Yeah, that's what they thought. They're not really for you to sit there and program it to do things.
Yeah.
I mean, someone's got to program it. But it's not for you to program it.
I'm sure there's lots of people at the moment shouting at the podcast who think, well, actually, I am somebody who programs.
Oh, yeah,
well done. That's great.
That's great. That's what you need. Do need people doing that. But I think when we were at school, there was this kind of idea that you would get a computer and it was like an empty box and you would program it to do things. But I mean, that's not how it's turned out. Yeah, some people, of course, program computers to do things and write programs, but that's not what the vast number of computer users do, is it?
You could see at that point at the end of the 80s how this technology, this personal computer technology, was going to be part of our everyday lives and shape us as DIY creatives. And if you're a role player, you just think, wow, this is great. Just think of the handouts I could create with it. And so it goes on.
And yet you say that, and yet I still can't create very good handouts on a computer. I can't really do things on a computer. Well, there you go. Says,
for some of us, then.
That's what's going to happen. But I suppose there's an odd thing there, isn't there? Like you say, with it being RPG adjacent, because my personal experience of computers and gaming is quite, I find it quite strange in that back in the 80s, yes, I was playing computer games on my ZX Spectrum and I was playing role-playing games. And there was a little bit of overlap where, like I say, you were writing the daft programs to create a RuneQuest character and all that kind of thing. As computer gaming became its own thing, I lost interest in it. I do not play computer games. I'm not knocking computers, because I suppose I do use a computer for gaming. Of course I do, because I go on Roll20 or Foundry, and I play most, as we've discussed many times, I play most of my gaming, as do you, on a computer. So it's not as if computer technology hasn't enhanced and influenced our RPG experience. But I certainly do not go, I've never played, I don't know, Zelda, Fable, Assassin's Creed. Never played any of them. Seen the kids playing them, but never played them. And what is strange, and I've never quite got to the bottom of why I feel like this, never wanted to.
Yeah.
Just never wanted to. No interest in it. I remember the kids when they were younger playing, I think it was Fable or Fable 2, and I remember sitting there and they were showing me how it worked. And I thought, hey, this is like a role-playing game. You know, it was, you could create a character and you had equipment and you wandered around and did this, that, and the other. But never interested me in the slightest, ever. I know there's the issue of time. So you think, well, I could say I haven't got the time to do computer games because I'm doing role-playing games and doing other things. But even if I had the time, I don't think I would do that. I wouldn't choose to do that. I just would not. And I don't know why that is. It's a strange thing because there is definite overlaps. And it definitely is like role playing, but I have no interest whatsoever in it.
Yeah, there is. It's different, I think. It's a different experience playing computer games. I'm slightly different in that through the 90s, I was playing console games, and I had a Nintendo 64, and I used to spend hours of my time playing things like Zelda. I think where I jumped off was at the point when it started getting more photorealistic and it became more of a graphical experience. I found myself, my hand-eye coordination started to diminish at the point where things started become looking a bit more real. Now I'd end up with characters standing in a corner, looking up in space and just walking on the spot. But I liked it when it was more cartoony and a bit more approachable. I think it's the professionalization of it that I've kind of jumped away from. But I spent hours doing simulation games like Civilization. I mean, I went into therapy to get me off Civilization because I was losing days of my life trying to have a cultural takeover of the globe by developing Hollywood or the internet.
I know what you mean. That's kind of an interesting aspect of it, isn't it? The kind of manual dexterity aspect of it. Because I know what you mean. When the kids were younger, they would sometimes say, oh, do you want a go, Dad? Have a go. And I'd have a go. And like you, I'd think, oh, mighty, I can't, what's all this? Move this, press that, do this, and do it quick, you know. And sometimes, I suppose, like with Call of Duty, my son would play that. And it was in a kind of online environment where you were fighting other players, you know. And you think, blimey, you know, he's really quick with... And as you said, that's a kind of odd thing, isn't it? Because I suppose that is a difference. A role-playing game, you don't really need the dexterity, do you? You don't need that.
You don't need the dexterity. And I think when we've talked about this in the past, we have had different experiences of it. Because it is the thing with the development of the computer games. Now they're very social because you do them online and people are interacting. My son has loads of friends who play together. But when we in the 90s when I was playing, it was something that I did and you didn't.
Mm. Yeah.
If we did have the potential to interact and play together, maybe we'd have done more of it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is true. It's like it was then a solitary act, wasn't it? Where, you know, if I wasn't interested in it, but then it wasn't as if you could say, well, I'll tell you what, jump online with me and I'll show you what to do. Well, you couldn't really.
Yeah.
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 That's true.
And I think that's why it's grown. I think it's grown because the reasons why the stuff we do in role-playing games has grown, it's because it's a collective act, a collective thing that you do together with your friends. You get together with your friends, and with things like GTA, you're world building together and doing things together.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the reason why there's a bit of a disconnect between us two in our relationship between both computers and computer games and console games, because just something that we did separately.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
What's your last artifact then? What have you brought?
My last artifact is, and I sometimes wonder if I've got this, actually really got this somewhere, is the bit of paper given to us by Moggy. Moggy, he who wanted to work for the Forestry Commission and worked and lived with 15 other children. He was one of 15, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Quite remarkable. But he had like older brothers, and he gave us a code for sort of hacking Manic Miner, which was a classic kind of 80s Spectrum game, wasn't it? Probably my favourite, actually. I'm honest, that's Manic Miner was my favourite. That was the one that obsessed me, I think.
I remember playing that in my room.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I remember when you got it, and we had been completely kind of taken by it, because up to that point, we'd played a few rubbish computer games, and Manic Miner was just like, blimey, this is like something that you would, when you're on your holidays, because that was kind of always the bar, wasn't it? When you went on your holidays, you'd go into an arcade, wouldn't you? Put your 10p in and play a computer game. So we used to play at Tron, or there was the dungeon one, wasn't it? What was the dungeon one called? What was it called, the one where you're in a little dungeon?
Gauntlet,
that's it. You'd play Gauntlet or Galaxian. And you wanted computer games to be like that. And I think Manic Miner was on a par with those games, and that's why it kind of captured our imagination. But it was very difficult.
It was difficult. I remember the first time I bought it from Games Workshop. They used to sell the games.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I remember us taking turns trying to beat the first level.
The first level was really hard. And there were about 15 levels, I think, or there might have been 20, I can't remember. There were a lot of levels. And eventually you got on to the next one and the next one and the next one. And then there was Eugene's Lair with the toilet going up and down, which was really difficult. And I remember us talking at school to Moggy about this. And Moggy said, my brother's given me a code. If you type this in, you can pick your level. You could pick whatever level you wanted. And it was an amazing thing, because you could go, all right, well, let's ignore Eugene's Lair. We'll come back to that. I'll go for the next level or the next one. And you could, you know, practice. And I think there was another one where you could get unlimited lives as well. Things like
that. Yeah, there was, yeah.
So I remember doing that. And I remember that being like the Manic Miner was amazing because of the way it looked and the way it was designed. But equally, the fact you could sort of cheat, I suppose, was an amazing thing. Because, of course, that whilst Manic Miner might have been on a par with those arcade games, the one thing you couldn't do in the arcades is cheat. You couldn't get to another level or anything like that. So it was equally amazing that you could put a code in and go, all right, oh, I've got level 10 now. I could go for level 10. I'll have a go at that.
I feel slightly different about it, you know, because I do remember playing that, and we played it in my bedroom, and my bedroom at that time had just been redecorated. It was an MFI Wonderland. Had these shelves made of red tubing with white shelves. Do you remember those?
Mm.
And
yeah.
Because I got this computer, my dad was convinced that I was going to start working for NASA. He allowed me to have the colour television in my room. And it was a colour television that they got in the early 70s. And it was like a piece of furniture. It was a walnut-cased TV that weighed a ton. It went really far back. My dad was a trained apprentice in engineering, and he built this really solid swivel base for it. And it sat on there. And people talk about loading how long it took to load games into the Spectrum. But I recall switching on that TV would take a lot of attempts because I had to look and keep turning it on and off, and there was a valve at the back that came on. And I had to get it so it clicked so that the orange glow started, and then I just had to leave it for a short while before it came on. And this TV in my room was like a great thing. You know, it's a big telly in my room. And playing, I just remember us taking turns playing Manic Miner. And none of us could crack that first level. We couldn't jump over that top hole. We kept getting killed by the weed that was there.
Yeah.
And then I cracked it. And I do believe that it's, and why it's ingrained in my memory is that it was one of the most remarkable achievements of my life. It remains to this day one of the most, working at it to get through it. And
was it an astonishing thing? I remember as well it being astonishing that there was another level.
Yes. Yeah.
I don't think when we played it we realised necessarily there was another level.
Thought we'd beaten the game.
I think we thought we'd beaten it. Oh, we thought, or I thought that a bit like Space Invaders, you would do the same thing, the same level, same thing, but it'd just be a bit harder.
Yeah.
I didn't realise that when you complete it, it's just a completely different thing. It was like the one called the Menagerie? It was the Menagerie, as I've
yeah.
said, I can't remember. It was the Menagerie with all these like pelicans bobbing around. You thought, oh my God, there's another level. It changes, and it changes again.
See, for me, those cheat codes, they devalued it. They devalued it because...
Oh, get off your gig. Bring your eye arse in. Come off it. Devalued it. What on earth are you talking about? We were 12, weren't we? Devalued it.
Devalued my achievement.
Don't do that. Just because I've said it's great now, you're going on your moral high horse, aren't you? Bring the high horse in at this point. You should have brought the high horse in earlier because...
Get away, high horse.
Bring the high horse in. It devalued it. No, it didn't. It was great. It was brilliant. Great, because let's face it, this was the end of the day, coming back to what you said, it wasn't that cheating, really, because it was just you on your own. If it had been a competitive game, that would have been terrible. It was me and you in some competition and me going, oh, I've got to level 17 now and not tell you about the core. That would be terrible. But it wasn't, was it? You were only messing
about. But Blythe, it was me against Matthew Smith. I was going to defeat it. This 17-year-old creator in his bedroom, and I was there in my newfangled bedroom. I was going to beat him. I had new curtains and everything, red with a white stripes.
I beat him just by putting a cord in.
Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye.
The Save Rap podcast covers old school gaming and the modern games inspired by them. Listen in to hear about games from the 70s and 80s, as well as their modern descendants. You can download episodes wherever podcasts are found, on iTunes, Google, and other fine podcast distributors. You should also check them out on saferhap.com or email them at saferhappodcasts@gmail.com.
I'll get me caught. Welcome to that part of the podcast where we're heading towards the door. We're not going to feel the benefit, but we're carrying on talking as we're reaching the door after our gaming session. And we've got a bit of a closing time chatter. And we haven't talked much about RPGs. So what's on your RPG mind at the moment, Blythe?
What's on mine? We've been playing Rippers, haven't we? Savage Worlds, Rippers.
Yeah, Rippers.
Mark's been running for us. And I think it's safe to say we both really enjoyed it, haven't we?
Yeah.
It's a bit of a different kind of spin on Savage Worlds, isn't it? Because it's sort of like a horror version of Savage Worlds. And when I say horror, I mean kind of It's like Hammer Horror, isn't it, really? Where you play monster hunters and you're hunting and fighting these monsters who are unashamedly, and I think this is kind of an interesting point of discussion, unashamedly stolen from fiction. So Dracula, Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Jekyll, The Mummy, all those things are in it, aren't they, as characters. He doesn't try and dress them up as something else. He doesn't have like a King of the Vampires. It says, no, it is Dracula. It is Dracula, you know, just in a different universe doing different things.
Yeah.
And it's kind of quite good fun, isn't it? And it really
I wasn't sure about it at first. It took me a little bit to warm to the idea. But yeah, I really got into it. You're right. I suppose it's like Deadlands, isn't it? Deadlands is Weird West with weird artifacts and weird magics. And this is a gothic London version of it. I think originally it came out in 2006 and it was revived in 2017. And you're right. It in terms of horror, it has more, it's more like, it's set in the Universal Monsters universe where, you know, you might see, I don't know, the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think we encountered Mr. Hyde, didn't we? It wasn't a surrogate Mr. Hyde. It was Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, Dr. Jack and Mr. Hyde are in it, and all those kind of characters are in it as those characters, but obviously with a different story, and I suppose in a different universe. So Dr. Frankenstein is Dr. Frankenstein doing what Dr. Frankenstein does, but it's a different storyline for him. But I think it's really, it's kind of interesting approach, isn't it? Because I'm not sure it's the approach I would take if someone gave me the brief to say, right, we want it's gothic horror, Victorian London, we want all that kind of stuff, Hammer Horror kind of stuff going on. I think I would have been tempted to dress it up in a different way, if you know what I mean, to have a Jekyll and Hyde character, but not say he's Jekyll and Hyde. But I think that would have been, that's a mistake. I think it's sort of interesting that they've just, so there was one of them where we went to Egypt, didn't we? And we were fighting these mummies. And I think at some point Mark said, well, it's the mummy. It's the mummy. That's what it is. And we all went, yeah, we know. It's great. This is great. You know, there's something about it where it's unashamedly, it's not copying, but it's kind of taken the right approach by not pretending to be something else, by actually just getting hold of all these movie kind of and gothic horror characters, got them by the throat and thrown them into that world.
Superficially. It's got elements that you could, was the same as Vasen, in that you do have, the role you're taking is similar to investigators or the archetypes in Vasen. There's the opportunity of base building, which we've not really developed an awful lot, but that is an element of it, isn't it?
Yeah, you have a lodge, don't you? Like a Ripper's Lodge where you are. Yeah, I mean, it's quite remarkable, actually, some of the similarities with Vasen. It's a different, sort of different type of game, but the underpinnings of it, as in what you're doing and where you are, quite similar, I think, yeah.
I think I saw that early on, but I think that it's tonally different than Vasen, isn't it? It's got a bit more sense of humour about itself, I'd say.
Yeah, it's kind of quite, it's kind of quite colourful, I suppose. I mean, I'm tempted to use the word pulpy, but everyone just uses the word pulpy about everything, don't they? But it does have a kind of pulpy quality to it, doesn't it? Or almost like comic book quality. But that's not to diminish it. That's actually quite a good and positive thing with it, I think.
You know? Yeah. I mean, my delight in it has been, I've been watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer from the beginning over the last year, and I'm able to play a Slayer, and I've based my Slayer. A bit obvious what I've named the character, Charity Winters. So I brought in both Faith and Buffy, because everybody knows that Faith is the greatest character in it. But it has been great fun playing that role of a Slayer and being able to develop that archetype as well, you know, with martial arts and The other element to it is rip attack. I've got some retractable claws.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. You can kind of use the monster tech to enhance yourself to fight the monsters. Yeah, and I think what's, again, going back to what you said about your character, one telltale sign of a good setting is that when you create characters, it's easy to create interesting and colourful characters. So we've all, the three of us playing it, have created interesting characters, I think. Like Steve's ex-soldier, and I've got a Russian Orthodox, a Rasputin-type priest, you know, and a kind of acrobat girl who's mute, who's got she's mute, can't speak because of some shocking that she's had in the past. We've all got interesting characters, and they were created very, very easily, and I think that's always a good sign with a setting.
That kind of links into my closing time chatter, because we're pausing Rippers on our Wednesday night club, and we're starting to play the Rackless campaign. And if you regular listeners will know that Rackless is the world I created for, well, we collectively created, but then it was abandoned by you and Eddie. But not that the bitterness still holds for 40 years, but we built this world together called Rackless, which was the site of our postal game that I ran for about 18 months. And we used to run adventures in it as well when we were playing. And it uses BRP, and I'm rebuilding it, redoing it from scratch. And I've run a few games at Virtual Grog Meet Just Gone. What you've just said about knowing the characters and everybody has an understanding around the table, I think it goes back to what I was saying last time when we were doing Thunder Phase, that when you're building something from scratch, it's really difficult to find those things that players can hook into.
It can be quite an unnerving experience, I think, strangely. And I don't know why that is, because we used to invent things all the time from scratch. But I think at times it can be a slightly unnerving experience, can't it? Because you wonder whether it's good enough.
Yeah.
It's all on. I think the problem is it feels like it's all on you. So if you run a pre-written thing, if there's a bit in it that's a bit rubbish or doesn't work very well, you could always go, yeah, that bit doesn't work very well, but there you go. That's what it says here.
I think more than that,
if you've invented it, it's slightly
more than that, Blythe. More than that, Blythe. What I found in the run up to the scenarios that I run for Virtual Grog Meet is the feeling that, does this not just sound a bit daft? You know, so when you're coming up with different tribes, you know, the Baltins and the Signes and the Stormwatchers and these, and you just say, oh, they just sound rubbish. It sounds stupid. It sounds a bit stupid. Are people going to buy this that I'm coming up with? I don't know whether it's a lack of confidence. I don't lack confidence in it normally, but it's just, it feels, have I got the courage of these? If somebody else is inventing them, I'd just put them out there and not worry too much about it.
Yeah. Well, I think that comes back to the fact that in the back of your mind, you think this is all on me, that I've invented all this. Whereas if it's some other setting, the weaknesses, and if there are perceived weaknesses and flaws in a pre-written adventure or a pre-written setting, that is someone else's fault. And there's also a sense that you read it and then think, oh, I don't like that bit. I'll improve it. I'll improve on it. Whereas if it's just you doing it, well, it's just you, isn't it? So can you improve on it? Well, no, because you think you've already improved it.
This is all I've got.
This is all I've got. Yeah, I think that is part of it. Because I'm doing a similar thing, because I'm coming up with an adventure, a dungeon for Into the Odd that I'm running in a few weeks' time. And that's a similar kind of thing where you think, There's not much in the way of scenarios for Into the Odd. And I think that's kind of part of the shtick with it, isn't it? That, you know, it's not about having some pre-published campaign setting and adventures. It's more about inventing your own thing. That's the whole point of it. But there is something, oddly unnerving and exposing about inventing your own thing, where, you know, it's like me. I've run a lot of Dungeon Crawl Classic stuff recently, and some of that's bonkers. It's daft, bonkers stuff, you know. But that feels all right, because it's a published scenario. Someone else has made up this bonkers stuff. So you can say to people, you know, you can almost say to people afterwards in the pub, yeah, it's bonkers, some of that, isn't it? Yeah, all that room with the big, yeah, whatever. Oh, yeah, that's bonkers.
It's not my fault.
It's a shield, yeah. It's not my fault it's bonkers. I thought, hey, I just thought, it's bonkers, but I thought it'd be interesting to see how, hey, I run it, you play it. Mm. Whereas if I'd written it, it's a bit like someone's, that was a bit of a rubbish bit, wasn't it?
Yeah. What the hell was that about? I came up with that.
That's my fault, that is. Yeah. So I know what you mean. It's quite can be a little unsettling, I think.
All I'm saying is don't be surprised over this campaign. You're presented with a square with 12 sectors in it and some red dots. That's all I'm saying. Use your own imagination.
Well, I'll just press some buttons and hope for the best.
Cheers, Blythe.
Goodbye.
There isn't another bit. Let me tell you a little bit more about that television. It's one of my earliest memories when it was delivered. It was incredible. Two men in long coats carried it in and put it in position. It was my dad's pride and joy until about 1982, when it was replaced by something more modern and less significant. I really wanted to have a television in my room so I could watch late night showings of stuff I wasn't really allowed to watch. There was always something illicit about being able to watch those special discretion required screenings on Channel 4 with a little triangle in the top corner to indicate that it might be a bit raunchy. It was always a bit disappointing in that regard, but it did introduce me to European cinema that might have passed me by otherwise, and it remains one of my prevailing interests thanks to that telly. It eventually blew up. Something must have been put down the back of it, perhaps a splash of coffee. I can't remember the trigger, just the white light, the loud pop, and the smell of burning. Ah, well. This is a point where I say thank you for the incredible support of the patrons and for you for listening. What were your experiences of the world of computer gaming? Join in the discussion over at Discord, on social media, or in the comments at the bottom of this episode on the grognardfiles.com page. Please, if you think someone would enjoy this podcast, pass it on. And if you write a review with 5 stars, it'll bring us joy and encourage us to go to line one and keep doing it. Why not visit Apple Podcasts anyway and read the transcript of the podcast? I think the Rise of the Machines has a long way to go as it tries to interpret my accent. Have you seen me die, Spike? From Dirt the Dice. Anyway, next time we're returning to RPGs and thinking about how technology appears within games. The future's bright. Adios, amigos. Going great.